our defining words.
Okay. This is ICANN 55, tech day meeting in Olivier on March 7th from 10 to 1645 WET. Is that it?
Good morning, everybody. Can we settle down, please? Excuse me, can we start or do we need to finish our deliberations first? All right, good morning. This is Tech Day at ICANN 55. I'm Eberhard Lisse. I'm reasonably well known so that I don't have to introduce myself again. It's, I think, the 27th Tech Day. And we have been struggling slightly with two cancellations, one only yesterday, but fortunately Christian Hesselmann was willing to step in on very short notice, so I could spare you and didn't have to give you my presentation about the Zika virus, which, as you know, I have done in my professional capacity for my colleagues in Windhoek. I have taken the science out so that it is good for lay people, but I thought it may be a topic on point would be better. As usual, quick rundown what we're going to do. André Suri is going to give us an update on developments with their name server. Then Marvin Wu is going to talk a little bit about IDN email. The Chinese core mail is, seems to be driving the spearheading this in many ways. Francisco Arias, is he here? I haven't seen him yet. He's going to speak about Ebero. That's the facility that ICANN has implemented with support of two or three backends. One of them is Nominet, where if a GTLD fails, they have a method to sort of sort that out. They were able to test this on a live TLD. .Doozan was a GTLD by a company that was basically not used. They relinquished it afterwards so they could actually see how this works in live, and they learned some lessons which they can talk to you. Then we, Attila Özgit, is he here? Is there? So if in case Francisco doesn't come on time, we may have to move you a little bit forward. And we'll speak a little bit about the DDoS attack that happened last year on .tr. I want to mention right in the beginning that this is a friendly audience here. It's always difficult for somebody to come and explain how they were attacked. And so the idea is that we all learn what happened, that we all learn what they did to mitigate it, and that we can all learn from how to prevent it from happening, and if that doesn't work, that we can learn what works, what we can do to prevent this. Then Christian Hesselmann stepped in on short notice with the OpsTLD presentation. Jeff Osborne from ISC will talk about the FRUIT deployment strategy. And Jaap Akkerhuis asked me for a small spot on quick and dirty DNSSEC monitoring. He asked me a few months ago when .bw had a little issue with the DNSSEC whether I know who to contact, and I was unable to. I even spoke to one of the people from .bw yesterday, but they couldn't help me. And then he mentioned he has a few shell scripts, and since it's I like easy to implement situations and solutions, so I asked him to show what he's doing. Let me move forward here myself, preferably. Somebody is interfering with my success here. So in the afternoon, Don Hollander, we had to rearrange the lunchtime a little bit because Don Hollander was having a full, I see him in the back, but he originally was going to have a full day meeting in the morning, or at least he couldn't do his presentation in the morning. Maybe his session will start a little bit later. But in any case, we were a little bit tied by availability of speakers, so we had to do the lunchtime a little bit out of the normal timing. Ricardo Schmidt from the University of Twente, is he here? There you are. Hello, how are you? We'll talk about Anycasting, and there also we had a little bit of an issue because we have an Anycast roundtable. We wanted to keep his presentation separate, but not equal, but separate, but connected to it, so that he could also then be still here when the Anycast roundtable started to share his insight on what's being discussed. And then Jacques Latour will do the usual closing remarks. So first we have, and I must say our lunchtime will be self-catering. Unfortunately, we haven't really figured out a budget for this yet, but I think we'll do. And André Souri will now start with the not version 2. We will present from this laptop. We can advance the slides, or you can advance the slides yourself. Or you can ask for the next slide, and it will be advanced.
Does it work? Yeah. Hello, my name is André Souri, and I'm from CZNIC. And this presentation is, in fact, about our new project, Knot Resolver. The previous one was Knot DNS, which is the authoritative DNS. And this is the recursive DNS server. Next slide, please. Okay. What is the Knot DNS resolver? It's not only a resolver. We view it as a platform for building recursive DNS services because it's so much flexible. It's open source, as all work we do at CZNIC. And it has a full DNSSEC support, including the elliptic curves, including the RFC 5011, which is automatic trust anchor management, and including the negative trust anchors, which is quite new RFC. Next slide, please. This is not next slide. Thank you. It's written in C and Lua, which is a very fast embedded language. And it's scriptable because the configuration file is, in fact, the Lua script. So you can program things inside, and that allows the daemon to, or the operator to reflect the current situation much more flexibly than just what the vendor releases. So you can you see a new thread, and you can just paste a snippet of code that will prevent the attack. It has a very simple core, which is extensible in the modules written in C, Lua, and Go language. We have support for Happy Eyeballs, IPv6, that gives 20 milliseconds head start for IPv6. And it has no internal threading. It's just one process, and it scales by replication. You just fire up a new process, and with the recent kernel feature, which is called SRU support, it will just bind to the same port and answer. The kernel will take care of the distribution of the queries between the daemons. Next slide, please. Still no next slide. Oh, thank you. So who is it for? Basically everybody. It's suited for large DNS farms, and I will tell you why in a moment. It's also suited for small recurses in private networks and for personal resolvers on your, laptops, and for all geeks, tinkerers, you, and people who like to play with DNS things. Next slide, please. So why large recursive DNS farms? Because it scales, and the really fast scriptable engine in Lua allows you to change resolution on the fly, to reflect your situation. It has a flexible shared cache backend. One of these is local, using LMDB. This is Lightning Memory Map Database, which is probably the fastest open source key value storage there is. And we have two networked cache backends in Memcached and Redis, also very fast. So networked nodes can share the same cache for the DNS resolving. And the new instances will, if you need more power, you just fire up a new instance, and it will just pick up the shared cache data, and the process will start in with hot cache. So the DNS resolution will be fast. It has great statistics, metrics, and plotting because of the graphite backend that can feed the data into, for example, InfluxDB and plot the data with Grafana. And it has negative trust anchors. It's cluster aware. There's etcd module for shared self configuration, and it can connect to etcd daemon and pull up the configuration that's shared between inside the cluster. It has support for views and ACLs, and it has a prefetching, so the cache stays hot before the records expire. Next slide, please. So this is just a plotting in the Grafana, so you see how nice graphs can be made from the data from the resolver. Next slide, please. So why small recursors in private networks? And I mean the home networks, the company networks. It could be, well, small to medium networks, even large, I would say. It has QNAME minimization, which is the recent standard in ITF. For DNS privacy, who doesn't know what the QNAME minimization is? So, who doesn't know? Okay, so everybody knows. That's great. Okay, so I will not explain that. It has a good DNSSEC and RFC 5011 key management. It has low memory consumption because the cache can be paged out to the swap. And it has query policy-based resolution, so you have flexible filters and based on pattern, suffix, response policy zone, and you can do all the stuff with that, like deny, drop, forward, redirect the query to TCP with the CC flag. And it also has DNS64 support to complement NET64 for IPv6-only networks. Next slide, please. So why for personal resolvers? It has a very simple config-less operation. You will just give it a writable file for DNS trust anchor, where the resolver can download the key from the IANA using the certificates, and you are good to go. That's all you need to run a Knot resolver. It has persistent caching because of LMDB, so it survives reloads, restarts, reboots of the daemon, It has a tiny web module for monitoring your queries. There's a live demo at the URL, or I will just show you on the next slide how it looks like. And for future work, we will improve even more privacy with DNS over TLS and DNS over HTTP, sort of to prevent all those. Also, a Wi-Fi on the hotels that will intercept your DNS queries and break it. So this is the output of the tiny web module. It will just show how fast the resolution of the names are, and a geo IP map of the servers queried. And even below, there's a list of queries. It's very calming and soothing. If you are compiling something, I just look at this and see how my resolutions are. Next slide, please. So for the geek tinkers, why? Because the KRSD, that's the daemon, is scriptable without binding on port 53, so you can run all sorts of Lua queries using well-documented API, and there are even example scripts. One is a KRSD host, which is sort of dig host-like utility, and the second one is the KRSD query, which you can exploit full API of in the Lua to do all sorts of things with the packets, with the queries, with the answers. This will just the examples here will just print the query name of the response and the R code of the response of the query you issue to that. The full API specification is in the documentation, which is on the next slide, I think. The Knot resolver comes with really good documentation. The URL is there. We are in the beta phase, almost coming to release candidate of version 1 on 1.0. And we are doing more testing to be really sure that everything resolves as it should, because the DNS is really broken. And there are a lot of broken servers out there which will just break the resolution, and you need to do so a lot of workarounds to make it work. So I would like to ask you, give it a try. We have a new website for that, where you will find all the resources for Knot Resolver. We have the Debian and Ubuntu packages with Fedora and Apple to come. And there are source codes because it's open source, as I already said. And even if you are really, really lazy, you can use Docker to just issue one command and it will come up and run. So throw a normal DNS and really weird DNS stuff on it and report back to us if you find any bugs. And even if you're successful and you are very happy with the program, we would like to hear from you. And I think that's all for me. So if you can show the GIF. Meanwhile, if you have any questions. So that's on our very good choice of name of the product. So any questions? Even you cannot.
Well, I can tie a knot, I can tell you that.
Okay, Jeff.
You said you had RFC 5011 support.
Yeah.
Sorry, can we take for the remote participants, give the microphone to the
Jeff Houston, APNIC. You said you had RFC 5011 support. One of our concerns in looking at that was that when we roll the root key and we're relying on RFC 5011, there's this issue of a 30-day hold-down period. But if I turn on my resolver in the middle of that period, I won't see the new key necessarily for 30 days. Have you allowed any manual override to learn that new key faster than the 5011 mandated 30 days?
I think it's quite easy. If you just delete the content of the file, it will just re-download the new key from the IANA website using the certificates. So
it should just pull it down,
yeah,
without necessarily relying on a 5011 role. Okay. Thank you. Your microphone.
Warren Kamari. Sorry, I arrived kind of late. Did you say it'll automatically pull down the key from the IANA website with SSL?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it does. A little exercise in the morning.
Dan York, Internet Study. So what's next for Knot? What are you doing next to it?
The word domination. I'm not sure what you are asking for.
What's your roadmap?
Our roadmap is to finalize the current 1.0 release and do more testing. And I think that the next stuff on the roadmap, the bigger things is SIT cookies, the DNS cookies. And the DNS over TLS will be probably there also this year. But we would like to wrap up this production release, to release the production release version shortly, basically, after we finish more further testing. I can switch my microphones.
Any more questions? Anything from the remote? All right, thank you very much. So, fortunately, we're running a little bit ahead of time, so Marvin Wu can make his way to the seat. Why don't you come and sit, or you can stand if you want, whatever is you prefer. You can sit or you can stand and use the microphone, whatever you prefer. You can advance your slides yourself.
Maybe you sit here as well.
Can you just advance the slide? Go totally back to the.
Okay,
let's have a look. Let me just
control you to myself. Or
you control.
You can do. Okay.
Okay. But
then so you only have to concentrate on the speaking.
Okay. Hi, everyone. No. I'm Marvin Wu from Cornell, China. This is the first time I show my product in the Tech Day. Thank you. Thank you, Al. Okay. My presentation includes four parts. Who is Cornell? What's IDN email? Email commercialization progress and some challenging and plan on EII. Okay. Cornell is the company do email only during 17 years. We are only do email. Was founded in 1999, with the same years with the IDN. So we catch more than 700 million users. Because Chinese has too many people, so we can get a lot of users. And this picture is our management team. Okay, so my problem is, who is me? In the right picture, the red colorless girl is me. Okay. Our team is funny and passionate. Okay, what is IDN email? IDN email is the email address contain international characters such as Chinese, Japanese, and so on. Now, our email address is only can contain English number, not like this. Now we can EII address can work like this picture. Okay. And we use some protocol and standards, include UTF-8 is our encoding. And some standards is RFC 6531, 6532, 6855, 6856. And that is a problem is our email system may need to reconstruction because before we support EII, our system only can support accept ASCII code. So our email system need to reconstruction again to change it to support Unicode. And we solve our custom to some to double email address such as this. Before I send email, the customer may choose which address he used, but they are the same email address. Just like me, my Chinese name is Wu Xiuchen, and my English name is Marvin Wu. So they're all the same person. And our email solution is like this. Chinese or any international username and alias name is the same account. Okay. So we solve double email address like this. For example, our main address maybe is support UTF-8, and we give the same address alias name, like English name, so they are can working as the same account. Okay. And when receive email, the system will be do a judgment if the receive can support EII or not. If Yes, we sent Unicode email to the receiver. If not, we give him ASCII code. And send is also maybe classify and do a judgment if the accept and is can support Unicode or not. So it's the same thing. Okay. So since 2012, Cromwell has the AI solution, but we found no application support AI and no email operation can support. So we can send email with ourselves, but it's very trouble. Now, Google, Microsoft can support it, but 2012, not only Cromwell can support it. So we have too many challenges. Now I can experience some things for us. Okay. The most challenging is no email operation can accept Unicode. Some users, netizens, interesting the AI, but they also ask me, but we have no place to register an AI account because Cromwell is an email system provider. We are not an email operator. So we release an AI register platform with China's CNIC. And we found our users, if he has an AI account, but no client can support AI because our client like Outlook, like Foxmail, and so on, only can accept ASCII code. So, Cromwell, we release some client name Flashmail, and we support some mobile client name is Cromwell's APP and Cromwell Link. So we have the full solution like Windows client and mobile client. If some enterprise customer need AI account, so we upgrade our SaaS platform to serve to give our customers. Okay. This interface is the platform that people can accept some AI account. If you have tried, you can try, and it can be free to register. Now, there will be more than 100,000 users in this platform. They are free, and they also is the real AI account. The name now can be applicant is HuLianWang.Zhongguo. It's real a Chinese name, but also we can support another language. Okay. So this our client's name, Cromwell's APP, Cromwell's Flashmail, Cromwell's Link, and we can support iOS, Android, and Windows. The right picture is our interface. And last year, we helped Thailand and India to make an AI platform to support the Thai language and Hindi language. It's India and Thailand. now they can work now. Okay. And in Chinese, we have some commercialization progress because a standard maybe to be used to make benefit is has okay. So in last year, we make some benefit for AI. The two customers, Huyi, is a registry that build a real AI solution used a commercial system, and they pay for me. So it can make benefit and commercialization. And our commerce platform SaaS users can also can use two accounts. One is EI account, the other is the English name. Okay. So the challenges, and also I said, no few apps can register. Because now email also accept to send and receive email. Also, email ID as a registered ID to use. Example, this ICANN's meeting, our registered ID is our email address. But you may find that also the only can accept English name. I could to try my Chinese username, but the system can't remember, can't accept. So this is a fairly big challenges because email address is also used to as a registered ID, such as some online games, mobile games, also used to registered ID. But all of these systems can't accept AI, can't accept Unicode. And so that is the big challenge. Okay, thank you. In the future, we think we also can popularize AI email in China. And the other non-English countries, by cooperation with some agents. If some people have interest, will be can connect me. And I think sometimes close areas will be okay, such as Amis, government. They also use the email in close areas. Maybe we can do these areas. Okay. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We can all give him a hand. You're not done yet. You're not done yet. I have a question from the chair. I don't really understand. If I send an email to any EIDA address, how does it find the way into your system? If I, for example, sent it to Russia, how is it going to work? I really don't understand how, if my mail client understands it, how does the resolution to find the MX record, and how does that work? How does this interface with the DNS? That I haven't figured out yet.
Interface and address is the two things, and the system will be judgment. Whether the receiver can support or not support. If the receiver can't support AI, we can send ASCII code to the receiver.
Now, if I'm trying to send an email address, an email to an AI address in a country, let's say to an Arab-speaking address, how does the DNS connect this? I don't really understand how the mail connects to the DNS, because you basically need to go and find your way through to your server. I mean, I get emails from you. You send it from your Chinese address, and it comes up in my ASCII address. I can see it here on the screen. Mm-hmm. So from the sending side, it works. I haven't really figured out conceptually how it works the other way around. If I was sending from Thunderbird or something using a Chinese address, how it would find its way into your system.
And your meaning is DNS, how to classify. IDN also can work. All still now can be work now. IDN, the domain name, DNS is works for domain name. DNA, IDN now is can be work. DNA is now. It's okay. Okay. So the email address is work before under the IDN. IDN is now ready.
Okay. Okay. Any questions from the floor? Okay. Any questions from the remote side?
Yes, we have one question from Calvin Brown. I'm going to read the question. As I will never be able to understand these emails, I'd be interested in ways to responsibly block them. Are you working on incorporating this as part of your offering? End of question.
Hello, Mark. Can you help me? Mark is Microsoft and do EI now. Let's say.
Do you want to answer?
So this is Mark from Microsoft. I really don't understand the question. Just because email is sent to an internationalized address doesn't mean that you can't read the content. The content could be in any language and in any script. It's just that now the address owner has an address in their own local script. So the first question is, I don't think a priori you want to block all EAI emails any more than you would want to block all .xyz TLDs. You remember there was a few months ago someone on the internet said, oh, you should block all XYZs. That was terrible.
That's not the question. The question is, I think he's in Johannesburg on the sick bed. He's booked off sick. So that otherwise he would come. He usually comes here. How can you block spam? Put them in a spam filter. How is this working with Chinese language? I can't have no clue what's
okay. Let me maybe try to rephrase the question another way. From what I understand is, when I use my email client, I have all kinds of rules to sort out my email. And I can say from my boss goes to priority, from my wife goes to priority, from XYZ, yeah, maybe later. If there's an email address that comes with from that has Chinese encoding characters like this, and I'm in the US with my basic version of Outlook, how does it work?
Or to make the point clear, if I get an email from mwu@cormail.com, I know it's him, it goes. If I get it from his same address in Chinese, I have no idea. How do I, now if I wanted to filter him, not necessarily as spam to block, but just to filter him into a folder, how would I do that?
So assuming your email client supports UTF-8, then parsing these strings is no different from any other address. And we are ensuring that these features are put into Office 365. The anti-malware, anti-spam front end is called EOP. There will actually be a discussion about EOP and EAI at, Lars is gone, in Cologne in April. I forget the name of the conference. We'll be talking about that. And then within the Outlook client, for instance, similar behavior, you have to recognize that the EAI address or the IDN version of the address are actually the same
address, and so you have to be able to do those conversions on the fly when you're doing searching and sorting. That's a feature that is being scoped. We don't have that yet. I'm not sure if I'm answering the question. From our perspective, as long as you understand that these are Unicode strings, you just treat them all the same. And so there's searching, there's sorting, and spam filtering.
Can you answer? Or have you any comment in this?
Maybe Dan can say anything.
Very diplomatic. Don Hollander.
Yeah, so it's Don Hollander here from the UASG. And to answer Kelvin's question, I think we're befuddled by the question because it's just another email address. It just happens to be in Unicode, or it happens to be in a script that you may or may not understand. Already today, and for the past forever, we have been seeing email address displays coming up in characters that you may not understand, even though the address is an ASCII address. And Eberhard, I'm not sure if you got an answer to your first question in terms of how do you find the MX record, but you just do a Punicode conversion, so you take the Unicode address, which is in terms of the domain name, convert that to Punicode, send that over the wire, and that finds the DNS record and points you to the right address for your MX record, and mail goes through. So the issues with EAI are twofold. The hard bit is how do you deal with a username or a mailbox name or the local part name or the name to the left of the at sign in left to right scripts. How do you deal with that when it's not in ASCII? So that's the hard part. The easier part is how do you display IDNs properly in your mail client? And that's just doing the conversion. That's pretty straightforward. But very few people are doing that, and that's what the Universal Acceptance Steering Group is pursuing, is to encourage mail operators to fix their code. Does that help answer your first question and Calvin's question?
I don't know whether it helps address Calvin's question. It helps my understanding of Calvin's question.
I say another thing. Maybe, yeah, it's a new thing. Maybe the email address is used not for us, because a lot of people can't understand English. I think maybe these rooms people no need to use EAI, because we all know English. We all can pronounce English address, but a lot of people can't remember English name. Like my father, he's a Chinese old farmer. He can't understand English, but I give him a Chinese account. He remember not soon, but I do email more than 10 years. She never use my product until I give him an EAI account. So I think EAI not for us, for some people, less knowledge to use EAI to touch internet.
Okay. No. I think the same point was made in Beijing by your colleague, who said it's absolutely clear. I mean, I can send you an email no matter what, but your own father or mother-in-law or whatever from the rural areas, my mother-in-law in Namibia can't doesn't understand English. Fortunately, she would use she can realize my name because it's in the same script. But I fully understand that for somebody who doesn't speak English, it's very difficult to communicate by email with their own sons who live in the town in a big city, because they just, you can type your message in Chinese, that will work. If necessary, you send it as an attachment, but you don't know how to type the address. I cannot type a Chinese address if that was the only choice. So that's It, I understand that. And it may not only be for, it's not just for China. It's the same in any other country where there is especially a large population that doesn't understand the language, but they have access to computers, and then they're barred from use from the computers because they just don't know how to address email to people that they want to communicate with. So that it makes all sorts of sense. Thank you very much.
There was a comment, another comment from Calvin, who said this question was more about the content. It's in the character set that he can't understand and he simply don't want it. And he would like to block it at the SMTP transaction level. That was a comment, not a question.
We'll defer the question for next time we see him. Okay, Francisco Arias will be next to talk about Ebero. And why doesn't Simon come on the panel as well in case there are questions or contributions that you can see? Francisco, it's on the presenting laptop already, so we can, if you sent it, so we can present from
there. You go.
Hello, everyone. This is Francisco Arias from ICANN staff, and to my right, I have Simon McCullough from Nominate. This is a short presentation of an exercise that we both jointly did a few weeks ago. This is the emergency backend registry operator. I'm going to explain what this is about. This is the agenda for the presentation, and let's go into the matter. So what's the Ibero program? This is a program within ICANN. This is related to the new ETLD program in ICANN. So all these close to 1,000 new ETLDs that have been added to the root have clause in their contracts that allows ICANN to take over the operation of the TLD if they reach certain thresholds of unavailability in each of the five critical functions. I'm going to explain later what these are. So the intention of the program is to protect the registrants within the ETL program from a registry operator failure. So if the DNS goes down, for example, for 4 hours, then we can take over that operation and restore that service as soon as possible. The Iberos, we have three companies that we have contracted for this service within ICANN, and they are the main qualifier for them is that they have years of experience operating registry services. That's the main characteristic that they have. And we have, of course, a contract with them, so we can have SLAs in terms of the things we expect from them. These are the five critical functions that I was referring to. They are laid out in the registry agreement, and they are also what we request from the Iberos to provide is DNS resolution, proper DNSSEC operation of the TLD, the operation of batch share registration services, meaning EPP, and we also require them to provide what we call in ICANN the registration data directory services. That's WHOIS, the port 43, and web-based WHOIS. And finally, we also request that the Ibero provider does what we call data escrow. That's on a daily basis, they provide a backup of the registration data to a third party that we have contracted to hold this data should there be a failure in the Ibero itself. So these are the three Iberos that we have, CNIC that you we probably know, Core in Europe, and Nominate. Now I'm going to talk shortly about how the Ibero event works. So what is an Ibero event? That's when a TLD fails or when the thresholds are met. So we have a monitoring system that we operate. This monitoring system is constantly checking the DNS and WHOIS at the moment. Eventually, we plan to add EPP monitoring. We monitor all the TLDs, and we basically are looking for response time. If they don't respond in a certain threshold that is defined in the contract, then we consider the service down. So the, we have a team within ICANN that is operating 7x24, and they are looking at these alerts, and if there is an issue, we first try to resolve the issue with the registry operator. If that's not possible within a certain time, then we start following their procedures, and eventually, if necessary, we declare an Ibero event and have one of our Ibero providers to take over the operation of the TLD. So far, we have had zero real Ibero events in the program. In other words, there have been no need to migrate the operation of a TLD to one of our Ibero providers. This is what will happen in an Ibero situation. I guess shouldn't be any surprise to all of you. We in ICANN have copies, daily copies of the TLD zone files for all the new TLDs. So as soon as we declare an event, we will make this zone file available to the Ibero provider, whoever the Ibero provider turns out to be. And we ask them to immediately sign that zone that we have available and put it up in their DNS infrastructure. Once that's done, then we will request a change from IANA to redelegate the TLD, and once that's completed, then we will have the service up in the DNS, of course, leaving aside caching effects and the if we are talking about a transition in which the old registry operator is not cooperating, then there will be also DNSSEC issues temporarily. On the side of the other services, the SRS, the Shared Registration Service, and the WHOIS, what we do is all the new TLDs have a data escrow agent that they have identified with us, and in, as part of that agreement that they have with their data escrow agent, they identify ICANN as a beneficiary of the data. And also in that contract, they have to put certain clauses. Basically, if they reach the emergency threshold, then we will have access to that data. So in the case of an Ibero event, we will call the data escrow agent and request the release of the data. The data escrow agents also have an SLA. They have to turn on the data, turn back the data within 24 hours. Once we have the data, then we made that available to the Ibero. All of this is properly encrypted and authenticated, the communications between us, the data escrow agents, and the Ibero providers. And then on their side of on the side of the Ibero provider, they have to import the data, cross-validated with the SOM file. We have a procedure to go over those validations. Basically, the whatever is the newest data, be it from the data escrow deposit or the SOM file, is the one that is considered authoritative if there were any discrepancies between the two sources of data. And that's the one that will be taken into consideration. So with that, then the Ibero provider proceeds to enable the RDDS and EPP service under ESCO. Once the situation is considered stable, then we have, in a normal situation, we will not allow updates to, not updates, registration of new domain names in a TLD that is under Ibero operation. We have a provision there to allow ICANN to request emergency updates to or an emergency registration of names in the TLD or deletions if they are, for example, say we are we know there is a new virus that is using the DGA names, and we want to turn it off, then we can proceed to add those names under the DLD. We also get periodic updates from the Ibero on how the situation is going, and they, of course, have to do data escrow deposits. Now let's talk about the specific exercise that we did. I should say that in the past we have done we actually do periodic exercises with all the Ibero providers. We take turns on doing exercises with them. But before this January, all the exercises we have done were synthetic. We were not using a live TLD. However, in last year, in September, we received the first request ever from a GTLD to terminate their register agreement with ICANN per contractual provisions that has a six-month window that ends on that ended in March 1st. So we had 6 months to, or sort of 6 months to plan the this exercise. To make things easier, that TLD had no registrants. It's a TLD that not actually launched in opening for registrations. And the registry operator was kindly enough to allow us to agree to allow ICANN to perform a live TLD exercise with their TLD close to the date when we were going to retire the TLD anyway. And nominate one of our Ibero providers agreed to perform this Ibero exercise, and we scheduled that for 26 January and exactly 12 UTC, to be precise. So now this is the timeline, and Simon, please feel free to interrupt me and add anything you feel is relevant to the discussion. These slides are merely timeline of how things went, but let's talk about any other things that we think are could be interesting to the audience. So the emergency threshold for DNS is 4 hours according to the GTLD contract. So if we simulated, I should say that this is a simulated failure within the TLD did not turn off DNS. We simply declared that at 12 UTC, we are considering that the service is down. So at 16 UTC, all these times are UTC, at 16:00, we consider that they reached the emergency threshold. So at that point, we started the normal procedure, and we tried to make this all as realistic as possible, trying to avoid giving heads up to most people if we could avoid that, so that we can really simulate what will happen in a real situation. So, for example, you can see that the next step is the declaration of the Ibero event. That's a procedural thing within ICANN. A certain set of people inside have to agree that there is in reality an issue there that requires takeover of a TLD. We take this thing seriously. This is not minutia. We are talking about taking over a TLD. This involves even going to getting an authorization from an ICANN officer. So, for example, in this exercise, I can tell you that it so happens that the preferred, let's say, officer that we will go to ask for authorization is Akram, the president of GED. And it so happens that he was traveling to China and had just arrived there. And so at the time of the declaration of the event, or when the declaration of the event will happen, it was past midnight there. And I called him, and he didn't answer. So that's the kind of things that happen. So I had to go to the next one. The next officer and who answered my call and explained the issue. I explained the issue, and he said, "Okay, go ahead." And after doing the rest of the process, that's why it took almost 2 hours to get the Ibero declaration, the Ibero event declaration, actually. Then we had our colleagues here in Nominate to start their process internally. They also have a 7x24 operation. They were very quickly in restoring the DNS service. As you can see, less than 4 hours from the declaration, from the when the emergency threshold was reached, we already had the DNS service restored within their servers. So the next thing we did was, of course, send a request to IANA. And here, this was one of the main things we wanted to test in here, because within the simulated tests, the synthetic tests that we did before, we had no way, or IANA had no participation in the tests, since there was nothing happening in the root zone. So we did this for the first time, and to our surprise and pleasure, we found that they were very quickly, all the actors involved, IANA, NTIA, and VeriSign, were very quickly enacting on the issue, treated as a real emergency, and the change was done very quickly. So the total DNS downtime and all of this is simulated, and of course discounting cache effects was 12 hours. So this is counting from when we consider the DNS service down, even though it was not down at 12 UTC. So by midnight UTC, we were having the service already up and running back in the public DNS. Now we go to the SRS and the RDDS timeline. Those were not the services that were failing, but according to the contract, if only one of the critical functions is failing, we take over all the functions in the TLD. We just didn't make sense to just take over one. We take the whole thing. Taking the starting time as the 16 UTC when the emergency threshold is taken, we requested the escrow release from the TLD data escrow agent in 2 hours and change. And there, for example, we found an issue with the with that process that did not allow the process to be made available within the SLA of the TLD. The SLA that the data escrow agent had. They have some technical difficulties attending our requests, and but eventually we received it. It wasn't way beyond the SLA we had there. And so when we had the data escrow deposit, we made that available to nominate, and they very quickly restore the EPP service. You can see the times there in the slide. And then for the RDDS service also, it's restored using the data escrow deposit from the TLD. So the total downtime that you can see from the RDS was, or simulated downtime, 2 days and 5 hours. Well, actually, in the RDS, there was actual downtime. Because the moment we made the change in the root zone, then of course there is no more WHOIS servers from the old registry operator working, since all the new utilities are required to offer WHOIS service within a name under the TLD. That's whois.nic.thetld. And finally, the last service that was restored is or function is the data escrow function that's with our own data escrow agent. We have a data escrow agent contracted for this purpose, but it so happened that in this exercise, data escrow agent that the TLD was using and our data escrow agent were the same entity. So that's the total exercise, as you can see, lasted for 5 days and almost 6 days. And after this, we had the TLD running with nominate until we finalized our internal procedures to be able to retire the TLD from the root zone, which that happened in 24 February. So nominate had the TLD running for almost a month at the end of the day. And I believe that's, just one more slide. So this is a summary of the timeline. It took all the services to be restored. We think at the end that this was a successful exercise. We were able to restore the services, some of those not exactly in the time we wanted. It took a little bit more, but it wasn't dramatically bad. And perhaps more importantly, in the case of DNS, I think a 12-hour turnaround from the time the service first goes down to the time when we see it back on in the public DNS. It's an impressive goal achieved with the help of our Ibera provider. Perhaps the other thing that I haven't mentioned before is the last bullet during the exercise. We were, as I said, we have a group of people within ICANN that are doing this, and we were taking notes of all the issues we found, and we also had nominate providing other issues they saw from their side on what we were seeing. And we found a total of 44 issues. Minor things, procedural things didn't work, people that have lost access to their keys or access to their servers that have to be reinstated in following other procedures. So we have homework to do to improve these processes. But in general, like I said, we think this was a huge success in being able to turn back the service in a live TLD with this Ibero simulation. Simon, would you like to add something?
Sure, thanks. I mean, I think everything you've seen on the slides is absolutely how it felt from our side as a provider. I think what was really interesting, I think it was an overwhelmingly successful test, actually, although we had some challenges during the test. I think what this was testament to was the fact that the Ebero process was built as a collaborative effort between the Ebero providers and ICANN. You know, this wasn't, although we are a contracted party from the Ebero, we provide a service as defined by the contract, and you can see all of that on the ICANN website. Actually, we built that process together over the course of probably a year and a half. And as we've been doing the tests, firstly a simulated sort of desktop exercise, and then finally with a live TLD, we've been learning as we go about some of the things that work, some of the things that don't work, and we've been doing that together. And I think that's a testimony to that process and how I think the future of some of these things will be built as the DNS changes and goes on. What we found, I think, was the stuff that didn't work was really minor stuff. It was silly things like PGP keys not being shared correctly, or escrow not taking longer, as we said, than we thought with the provider, the third-party provider. But the fundamental tech and the fundamental basis of the process works really well. And I think that's great news as we go into potentially a round two of GTLDs, where there could be thousands more GTLDs, knowing that actually we can fail them out, move them on, and then fail them back again in a relatively short order and successfully with minimal downtime, I think is a good thing. So I think, you know, ultimately the program works. So, yeah, positive experience from our perspective. Totally agree. We've got a whole ton of issues that we're now, little tiny ones that we're resolving and baking into the next process. I think when we do another test with on the other providers, I think it will be even slicker than this one.
Thank you very much. A little bit of an applause is always warranted and appreciated.
Paul Wouters. What was the TTL on the DS record? And I'm assuming you did have to change the DS record for that TLD or not?
So the TTL, I believe all the TTLs in the root zone are 48 hours.
So that means that the outage that you have could be up to 48 hours.
Right, that's what I meant when I said this counting or not accounting for. I guess I should have said not. It's there. Well, catch effects. Yep.
Yeah, but now you put it large on your screen to say like, oh, that's only like 3 hours, and then we were back up and running. But now you're really saying like it was like a day.
Yes, it's true.
So that's quite a difference.
I think it does depend on whether people are prefetching and other effects, and we know that happens with DS records as well as others. So.
Thanks. Just a point, actually. I think what's important to note here about Ibero is that it's not the same thing as fallback. It's designed for systemic failure. It's designed for failure of the actual company, organization, etc., not just saying we'll provide a backup that will take over if this thing actually technically fails. It's more than technical fail, it's organizational fail as well, isn't it?
Not strictly. I think the definition varies, but in principle, and we've seen in the past, we've been made ready where there's been potential technical failures or difficulties and not the failure of an organization. So it could be brought into use if there was a significant systemic technical failure.